To introduce our speaker for tonight, Jim from Santa Maria. Come on down.
My name is Jim, and I'm an alcoholic. And I want to welcome everybody, and no one here in the first 30 days, because I didn't admit it either, so. Well, I want to tell you that you've done a wonderful job so far, and I was introduced as Jim from Santa Maria, and that's exactly how you're supposed to do it. But if you look closely at that tradition of anonymity, it says anonymity at the level of press, radio, and film. And I always had a tough time when I was first getting going. I would meet some of the best friends I ever had my whole life in AA, and I would be very excitedly go home and tell somebody about them and what a great friend they were and how well we got along and how much help they were to me. And then sometime later, I'd meet them in the mall or at a coffee shop someplace and have no idea how to introduce them because I didn't know what the heck their last name was. It was just Fred or Jack or somebody. It just never made much sense to me. So I want to tell you this. I am nobody famous. Nobody in my life has ever asked me for an autograph. I've never written a book. I've never done anything really worthwhile till sobriety, maybe. So I don't mind telling you, because it's Sunday night, kind of a nice intimate group here. I'm going to tell you what my last name is, because I don't like that anonymity other than outside of this room. My last name is Glines, and it's G-L-I-N-E-S. And to be perfectly honest with you, there was a time in and about the community of Santa Maria that virtually every bartender, every cocktail waitress, everybody associated with an establishment like that, all knew who Jim Glines, G-L-I-N-E-S, was. And they knew that when he drank and he went on a toot, it inevitably led to one thing, and that was trouble, and it was usually big trouble. And since we're being so honest, I'll also tell you that in and about the community of Santa Maria at about that time, there were several members of the law enforcement establishment, police officers, motorcycle cops, beat walkers, guardians in those bars I was talking to you about, and they, every one of them knew who Jim Glines, G-L-I-N-E-S, was, and they knew that when he got into those honky-tonks and establishments and started to drink, it inevitably led to one thing, and that was trouble, and usually that was big trouble. And since I'm being so honest, and it's a Sunday night, and we're an intimate, really, really honest group, I will also tell you that in and about the community of Santa Maria at that time was a couple of ladies of the evening, and one time one of them happened to call Mrs. G-L-I-N-E-S. That was big trouble. Now, you could laugh at it today. Back then, that was a lot of trouble. And I will also tell you that she's now the ex-Mrs. G-L-I-N-E-S. And if her last words to me ever come true, I'll be the late Jim G-L-I-N-E-S. So now you know who I am and you know a little bit about me. And I'm going to tell you that on the 17th of December in 1981, I would like to tell you how willingly I walked through that back door there. As far as I know, Mark has told me they've tried and tried. They can't get the scratch marks off the door or on the floor where I was clawed as I dragged in here. And I gotta tell you, I got a real kick out of that sign. That wasn't here when I came, and I'm kind of glad I could read that sign and convince myself for another several years I was not an alcoholic. Probably an alcoholic? I got news for you. If you're here tonight and you're wondering if you're an alcoholic, you need to go no further. Don't worry about reading stuff. Don't worry about taking a test. No one ever got here by mistake. None of us ever went to our high school counselor and said, boy, if it was possible, I'd love to get out there and get a degree and go out in that world and accumulate a few things and then destroy every loving thing I own because I drank too much. Destroy families, destroy homes, destroy children, destroy houses, destroy everything you had because you drank too much. And I will also tell you that nobody ever walked in this room the day after New Year's Eve and said, boy, I got a little tipsy last night. I better run down to AA and see if that's where I belong. This place to the outside is like a leper colony, and it's the last place in God's world any of us ever wanted to wind up. And yet it's the place we came to find miracles and to get our lives turned around 100%. And I've got a little bit of a challenge tonight that I'm going to tell you about, and I need you to go along with me just a little bit. But my friend Mark, and by the way, this guy and I go back for at least two generations and maybe three, but I will tell you, his grandmother held my dad's hand as he passed away at Marion Hospital. So that's how far back these families go. He asked me to talk a little bit about the history of the 1600 Club. So I'm not sure how to incorporate that into my particular story, but I will tell you, my dad was an alcoholic. And by the way, you just met the third generation of our family tonight that followed that same reckless path. Finally, thank God, found Alcoholics Anonymous. But my dad got sober in April of 1953. And at that time, I was 10 years old. I'll give you a minute to think how old I am now, but I was 10 then. It's always the same. And I certainly do remember my dad's drinking. We lived, we actually lived at the Rockfront Ranch, which is out on Highway 166. I'm sure a lot of you have been out there. And today, that whole thing is open to the world. Back then, it was pretty private area, pretty remote, and pretty desolate. But anyway, my dad's an alcoholic. He comes to, we came to Santa Maria where I went to school, and he finally came to the point that he thought he might do something about his drinking. And I don't know for sure, but I've heard him talk. There were probably about 10 people in Alcoholics Anonymous sober at that time. I don't think there was a lot more than that. And interestingly enough, they had their meetings in people's houses. And so they would meet. And by the way, they went as couples. My mom went to every single meeting. And whether the man was the alcoholic or the lady, they all went to the same meeting. And they all spoke in a discussion meeting. They'd ask the non-alcoholic partner to speak. And they smoked cigarettes like, my Lord, they'd light one after another. It was horrible. And their coffee, I swear, if you dropped a horseshoe in it, it wouldn't sink to the bottom. It was the rankest, awfulest coffee ever. But they sat there smoking cigarettes and drinking coffee and clung to each other and stayed sober. So, of course, the group began to grow from that point. And I remember that at one point, this is a great piece of history for you guys. At one point, they rented a kind of a dilapidated old hall. And it was at 1600 North Broadway. And I'm not even sure what's at 1600 North Broadway today, but that was that club they rented. And they rented that sometime, I'm going to say, in the late 1950s to early 1960s. And then they outgrew that building, and the landlord kind of wanted them gone because they wanted to do something with the building. And so my dad and his grandfather, I had an uncle, ironically, that was not alcoholic, but he was manager of the Bank of America, and he joined the 1600 club because he knew about my dad's issues. And two or three other people formed the 1600 Club as a nonprofit corporation. They went to Bank of America and borrowed the money to buy this property right here. And this was an old kindergarten building that you're sitting in now. This was a kindergarten building for a good number of years. And then they cleverly got together to have a big debate on what to call it. So what do you suppose they called it? The 1600 Club. Is it at 1600 any street? No. But that's where they came from, the 1600 North Broadway. And that name clicked, and they kind of liked it. So you're now sitting in the 1600 Club. After a while, they grew to the point. They charged AA to have meetings in these rooms. And I'll be doggone, they got the mortgage paid off. I remember, I was, I probably wasn't drinking then. I wasn't old enough. But I can remember my dad talking about having a mortgage burning party. And they had some kind of a party out here, and they burned the mortgage, and this property became free and clear. And that was a miraculous step in the history of Alcoholics Anonymous in the Santa Maria Valley. And then, of course, over the years, groups spread out every place. For a number of years, this was about the only show in town. But then we started to develop meetings in Orchid. We started to develop meetings in South Santa Maria and all around the countryside. But back in those days of the 50s, it was kind of a big deal to get to an AA meeting. And they were held mostly held in people's houses. And that's kind of the roots of where we all came from. I told Mark that's kind of in our DNA, that's where all got started. And you know the miracles that happen once you decide that maybe Alcoholics Anonymous is for you, because you open your mind. I love this over here where that contempt prior to investigation. All of us, if we're honest, have that before we come here. You come here and you get your eyes open and you start to live sober kind of one day at a time. I'm going to tell you that in my case, because we were out at that ranch and we were pretty desolate, I wasn't exposed to much alcohol. Certainly once my dad quit drinking, it wasn't around the house anymore. And I went to St. Mary's parochial school here, not much alcohol there, and went to high school. And when I went to high school at Santa Maria High, they didn't have certainly there was no such thing as drugs back in those days, and they really didn't have the alcohol availability. And I kind of ran with a group of kids that came off of ranches and worked pretty hard on the weekends. We didn't have a lot of opportunity. I went to college at Cal Poly and got up there, and I found out some of the guys were having a little bit more fun than it seemed like I was. But I was involved in some organizations up there, and I'll tell you, back in those days, they were pretty tough on catching kids drinking and doing stuff they weren't supposed to do. You get kicked out of school pretty easy for the slightest violation, certainly unlike today. So we were pretty straight arrow up there. I mean, they kind of had my attention, and I knew what was waiting for me if I came home. So I pretty well behaved myself. After college, oh, by the way, I just got to tell you this story because it's so cool. When I told you I knew what was waiting for me at home if I got in trouble at school, I have a friend that runs Billy Bob's in Fort Worth, Texas. And Billy Bob's is the world's largest honky-tonk. It seats 8,500 people. They've got like 47 bars. They got bands and they got bull riding in one corner. It's the biggest, most magnificent building you ever saw in your life, and the alcohol flows there like you wouldn't believe. So they got security guards all over the place, and they watch for people that have had too much to drink. They certainly watch for underage drinkers. And the guy that owns that was out in California not far back, and he said to me, I got a story to tell you that's going to remind you of your family. And I said, tell me what it is. He says, I was walking down in the security area of Billy Bob's in the last couple of weeks, and he said, we had a young boy there sitting in a stool. He said he was 15 years old, and he was so drunk, he didn't even know what town he was in. He was just absolutely plastered. And he said, the security guy said to him, he said, son, how'd you get this way? And his kid said, well, I came with my cousin. He's older than me, and he bought me the booze, and it was wonderful, and I had never tasted it. And this guy says, you know, he said, I can't let you go. And he said, what your cousin did is terrible. It's against the law. So he said, son, I'm going to give you two choices, son. He said, I'll do whatever you want to do. I can either call the Fort Worth Police Department to come and get you, or I can call your mother. And his kid sat there a minute, and he says, would you call the police, please? That's the kind of mom I had. If I'd ever got caught, I didn't want to take my chance with the police. I knew what was waiting at home. So I got out of school, and I was my folks had sold the ranch in the meantime, and they'd retired. I had to make an honest living. And I went to work for a major bank, Wells Fargo Bank, as a matter of fact, and I was over in the San Joaquin Valley. And I was on a program called a management training program where they would take youngsters just out of school and put us on a program deal where you spend so much time doing this and so much time in loans, so much time collections, all that stuff. And then was assigned eventually as an officer someplace, and I'll be doggone, when I got that job, they explained to me what an expense account was. And I liked that a lot. I thought that was really cool. And then I found out that the higher up the ladder you got, the more they expanded that expense deal. And I went to lunch one day, and this guy was not alcoholic, but he was a branch manager. And he took this big-time customer out to lunch. Now I'm talking about probably the late 60s when two or three martinis was pretty well accepted at lunchtime. That was kind of standard. Jimmy Carter once said if you had more than three martinis at lunch, you couldn't write it off. That was beyond business. You were in trouble. So up to three, it was okay. So we went to lunch at this country club kind of setting. And I was very careful about what I drank. I hadn't drank a lot. Wasn't real used to it. We got back to the branch. The manager called me in his office, and he said, the next time you go to lunch with me and a customer and you don't keep up with him drink for drink, you're not going anymore. These people expect us to buy. They expect us to join them. That's what's expected of you. Okay. So guess what? And the next thing you know, I didn't know it. I really didn't. I just thought I was a two-fisted, heavy drinker, work hard, play hard, all that kind of stuff. But I started getting into trouble with alcohol, and I started drinking more than I should. And doing some things that I shouldn't have been doing and hanging out where I shouldn't be hanging out. A lot of you guys all know that road. It was kind of interesting. I look back on it now and I'm thinking back then that bank was really growing fast. And by the way, they were coming to the central coast of California and Southern California where Wells Fargo had never been. They had never been in this part of the country. So I moved on to Fresno and I moved up. I think I had my first manager job in Hanford. And I was moving every couple of years, so you know what? I kind of get in trouble someplace, and boom, they transfer me. I got to start all over again, kind of got to get out of jail free card, and I could start that process again. And I'll be doggone if they don't wind up asking me if I'd like to go back to Santa Maria and manage a Wells Fargo bank. They had just bought a community bank here. It was called Los Padres Bank, and it's on the corner of Main and Miller. Wells Fargo is still there. It still shocks me. I left them, and the doggone thing is still open. It's almost like they didn't even miss me at all. But I went there. And that was not a good deal. My dad was, you know, AA has no structure, but if you grew up the way I did, my dad was president, by God, of AA. I knew he ran everything. He and his friends used to tell me they had a chair down here with my name on it, and all I had to do was come down and claim it someday. And while they thought they were kind of kidding, I didn't think that was the least damn bit funny. So I just, one thing led to another, and it led to a divorce, and it led to a loss of a home, and led to some miscommunication, and not total loss, but certainly a separation with my children, and things were kind of bad. But I was pretty convinced I was a victim of bad breaks, and it hadn't been for alcohol to get me from kind of one tragedy to another. I don't know how I got by. That's kind of what it did. And so things went downhill, and believe it or not, at the end of 13 years, we were managing the most profitable bank they had in Southern California, and I'll be a son of a gun, they come up to talk to me about my drinking. I couldn't hardly believe that. And the guy from Southern California said, I feel really bad because I recently had to let a manager in Southern California go because he drank too much. And I hope that doesn't happen again. I said, boy, I do too. Why didn't he go to AA? And I was kind of all for it. By the way, I knew a lot about AA, so if they want to talk to me about coming to AA, I came every year for my dad's birthday. I could have recited the 12 steps, 12 traditions. You know, do they still have that 10-step? It used to be a questionnaire. You took 10 steps, and if you missed more than four, you're alcoholic or something. I took that thing till I had it all memorized. Never missed. Gave it to my friends at Shaw's after a little rehearsal. We never missed any of them. We passed just fine. So I knew a lot about AA that I could quote to them. But that job came to an end, and that marriage came to an end, and then the house I had came to an end. And everything I had, I was financially, spiritually, morally, every way in the whole world bankrupt. I was void of everything. And it was a really difficult time for me in my life. And it was a time when that ego of mine had been fed to the point you couldn't hardly fit it in this room. And here I am on the street without a job and wondering what the hell just happened and you know, why me? And so, by the way, several of you wonderful people suggested they might know what was causing my problem, and I ran from that like I would a leper. I didn't want to hear any part of that stuff. And so, I kind of just stumbled along, and ironically, I met a lady, and I liked her a lot, and she seemed to like me, but I never could kind of close the gap on that deal. She sort of like stayed here, and I was kind of here, and I never could get any of this stuff to happen, even with all my charm and the tremendous future I told her I had. And so that was kind of weird. And one day, I can tell you when it was. It was in December of 1981. I was going to meet her for lunch, a really high-class place because they had paper napkins, and she was late for lunch. And I sat there, and by the way, I'm one who said for years I never had a spiritual awakening. Listen to this. I sat there waiting on her, and I had a paper napkin, and I was really overcome with all the bad stuff that happened in my life, all the stuff I'd been through and lost and wrecked and whatever. And it was really weird. I've kind of put little X's on the napkin, you know, lost that job, career, and then lost this house. And then, you know, kids, mom moved away and they moved away and that happened. And then this deal, oh, there's another divorce I forgot that was in here. And all of a sudden, I kind of thought, and I remember this like it was yesterday, I kind of thought, you know, it's a good thing there's alcohol, because that's really what got me from one of these tragedies to the next. That's why I held up, was thank God I had that to lean on. And then I went, oh my God, no spiritual awakening, you understand. Then I said, wow, there's a common denominator in every problem I've ever had. Every problem I've ever had in my adult life has a common denominator, and that's alcohol. And then this woman showed up that I thought I loved, who was going to betray me. And I said to her, wow, you'll never guess what I just did. And she goes, well, I showed her the napkin. And I said, look at that. Did you know that alcohol is a common denominator to all this stuff? And I expect her to be shocked. And she said, yeah, I knew that. And I said, well, you never said anything. And she goes, I couldn't. And I said, I don't know what to do now. And she says, I do. I think, listen carefully, I think we, that would be both of us, right? I think we might should call your mom and dad, and maybe we should go over there and talk to them about what you just discovered. And I said, you know, it might have come to that. I couldn't believe I ever agreed to that, but it might have come to that. And then she said, call them from a payphone back in those days. Some of you people may not even know what a payphone is. They didn't have these things back then. I called them from a payphone. I asked my mom, I'd come over. She said, of course. And I look around, and this lady named Kathy is gone. She's out of there. And I'm like, what happened to her? Later I found out she went back to work. We weren't going anyplace. I was going over there. So I walk into my house, and I don't believe there's anybody here that ever knew my dad. He was a rancher, a cowboy, tough, man of very few words, not always the happiest words. But I walk in that front door, and my mother said, what's up? And I said, I think I might have a drinking problem. And my dad started to cry, this big, tough guy. I don't think I'd ever seen him shed a tear. And my mom ran for the phone. And I'm like, I wonder what's going on around here. Next thing I know, a guy that I used to drink with, by the way, and I noticed he hadn't been in the bars lately. I thought something must have happened to him. He shows up at the front door, and he said, your mom just called me. And she said, you think you might have a drinking problem. And I'm like, well, let's not jump to too many conclusions here now. I'm not making any kind of commitment. And he says, well, by the way, he was a superior court judge. This dude had something on the ball. And he says, well, let's go in this private room. We'll talk a minute. And I said, good. That sounds good. We go in this room, and he says to me, and by the way, he'd handled some of the legal crap I got into, so I'm not kidding him. And I thought it was, but I wasn't. He sat in his room a minute, and he says to me, you know, he said, you might not be an alcoholic. Finally, I'm talking to somebody that's got some brains. And I said, no, I might not be. I just had a string of bad luck. I need a break, that's all. He says, why don't you make me a deal? He said, can you go 30 days and not drink? And this is December now. I said, anybody can go 30 days and not drink. I do it every January, never failed. He goes, well, how about you make me a deal? You think you can go 90 days and not drink? And I said, yeah, sure, of course I could. I can quit anytime I want to. He said, how about tonight, you and I go to an AA meeting, and you promise me you won't drink, and in 90 days, we'll go to 90 meetings, and at the end of that time, you can decide if you're alcoholic or not. And if you're not, get back out there and go for it. And if you are, now you're all familiar with the program, you got 90 days going, you're on your way. What do you got to lose? I went, damn. I didn't like the way he presented that. I didn't like what I had to put up against what have I got to lose. But I was committed, and I'll be doggone that night, sure as hell. He comes by, picks me up, get in the car, down here we come. I'm telling you, scratching claw marks all over the door. You people acted like you'd expected me here for years. There was a lady that my dad had sponsored who was, by the way, before you think anything about wet ladies sponsoring men, she was my mother's age or maybe older than my mom, that my dad had sponsored, and she came up to me and she says, well, Jimmy, she said, do you think you might have just a little drinking problem? And I said, I don't know. I'm here to find that out. And she said, well, your vote would make it unanimous. So with those kind words, I came to my first meeting. The Friday meeting here used to be a podium participation meeting. It was a discussion, and you call people and come up here to talk. And that was the first meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous I ever attended. I want to tell you, by the grace of God and this wonderful miracles of this program and some of the great people in my life, I haven't found it necessary to take a drink of alcohol of any kind, no mind-altering drugs, no nothing, since the 17th of December, 1981. If I can make it, for us math people, numbers are important to me, I get till December of this year, it'll be 40 years. And that's pretty much impossible to believe. So I come to AA, and I start grabbing on this program, and then you might know, if you got a personality like me, after about 2 weeks or 30 days, I got figuring out how AA worked. I figured out where the cliques were. I figured out where the leaders were. I figured out that if you want to go someplace and have coffee after the meeting and criticize the speakers, I knew how to do that. And I got into all that stuff. And I did all that stuff. And then another 30 days, I found out the only clicks in AA was a clickety click click that was going on between my ears. And I found out the only leaders and speakers we resented were the ones who didn't tell our story just the way we wanted it told. And I will tell you, long, long before the 90 days was over, it became clear as hell to me that I was in the right place and my future was here. So I went to work for a wonderful man named Chuck Hibbard, who had Home Motor Chevrolet. Some of you may have known him. Passed away here just a couple of months ago, but a great, great man. And I'm kind of off and running, starting over again. And I get going. And this, I was thinking about this today. I'd been there a couple of years. I started there in about the time I came to AA, about December. And in 1983, I was in the back lot, and the secretary there, they had a lady on the floor that had that big speaker thing where you hear it all over Hell's Half Acre when they say something. She had Jim Glines come to the showroom. And I go popping up there because by now, pretty much all my problems are behind me. Everybody knows I'm starting a new life. I'm AA. The bill collectors are kind of dwindling, and I don't have a lot of problems. And as I got up there, this lady comes away from, I knew her quite well, comes away from her booth, and she says, hey, there's an attorney out waiting for you in the lobby. I'm telling you, I think there's still a wet spot on the floor at Home Motor Chevrolet where I was standing. I went, oh, man. And then I get, why me? You know, here I'm doing the right thing. I'm a spiritual giant at AA now. Gosh, I've had sobriety. I'm doing everything right. Now I see this attorney. I just drag into him. He introduces himself. He happened to be in Lompoc at the time. And he says, we need to talk, and I want to talk privately. I just put my hands out now and go off to jail, or what do I do? So we go in this office. We shut the door. And he says to me, I'm the chairman of a board of a bank over there. And he said, we have need of putting a branch in Santa Maria. I think you'd be a good manager for us. How would you like to get back into banking? And I'm telling you, I sat there, I looked at him, and I fought back tears. I didn't know whether to just grab him and hug him and wrap my legs around him and just whatever. I wanted back so bad I couldn't see straight. But I'm really cool, so I said, well, I suppose it's something I would consider if the right thing came along. And he said, well, it's the right thing, and it's here. And I went over in a couple of days and had dinner with his board, and they put an offer on the table. And I thought, wow, the miracle of AA is starting to help me get my life back in order. You know what happened? About 3 days later, I get a call from another bank, another chairman, and turned out that was Bank of Santa Maria. And this is 1983. And this guy called me up, and he says, we got a spot in our bank for a loan officer. And he said, we would really like you to come aboard and be one of our chief commercial loan officers. I'm so stupid and so arrogant, I'm kind of like, well, I don't know if I'm going to. A week ago, I'd have run all the way to his house. But now, I got this offer, got a head about this big. So I'm like, I don't know if I want to go to work for your bank or not. I have an offer to be a manager of a new bank going to open up. And he called me in for an interview. And by the way, I grew to absolutely love this man. And he passed away about 3 months ago, probably. His name was Bill Harris. He was president of Bank of Santa Maria, chairman of the board of Community Bank of Santa Maria when we opened it. I got in his office and he said to me, I think you'd fit this bank well and we'd like to have you here. And I said, I'm telling you, why would I do that? I got a job as manager coming up. And he said, if you're as good as you think you are and you come to work at our bank, you'll be manager before that other bank even gets open. And I kind of went, sometimes we need to be talked to like that. And of course, I thought it was that good. So turns out I accepted that job. You want to know something funny? That attorney that was the first one to come to my mom and dad's house and brought me to my first meeting, unbeknown to me, was on the board of directors of that bank. He's the one that put that in for me. So you want to talk about being able to turn your life and will over to the care of God and things happening for you? You put that little string together I just told you, and you tell me there's no high power someplace. You tell me that's all coincidence, because for a long time, I took credit for the whole thing. And then I realized I'm sitting here trying to screw it all up, and God's doing what I not only don't see, couldn't do if I wanted to. So guess what? I go to work for that bank. Turns out he and I got very close. Bank of Santa Maria sold in 1998 to another bank. Our careers kind of floundered a little bit. We got together in 1999 or 2000 and decided to start our own bank. And 2001, we opened Community Bank of Santa Maria, that you know today. We are now 20 years old. He's passed away. I'm retired as a chief executive officer. I'm now chairman of the board like he was. And I want to tell you that there's not a step of that process that I just went through with you. There's not one step that I had anything to do with. That's humbling for me to say that to you, but that's the God's truth. There's none of that I had anything to do with. I got sober. I started trying to live right. I started trying to. It's tough to turn things over. It's tough. And you know what? I went sometime during this whole process. I went and saw a movie that was called Rocky. Remember the very first Rocky movie? And I felt like Rocky Balboa. I felt like every time somebody knocked me down, I just had to get back up, spit out the blood, and run into that buzzsaw one more time. And I thought, when I finally just decided to crawl out of the ring and take that rag I was holding on to, take that with me, leave it there and not try to hold on to it, good things started to happen. But you know what? When good things start to happen, I tend to kind of reach back in and want to grab that rag again and go, maybe I could. And that's baloney. That's baloney. Turn it over to God. Let God do it. You got to do the work. You can't sit in your car and pray for a good job to come along. Probably not going to happen. But you turn those things over to God. And I could tell you story after story after story. You want to hear one? I'll embarrass this 20-year member of AA. I'm sober 20 years, I guess, and I'm looking at him, and he's a deputy sheriff in Siskiyou County, California, deputy of the year 1 year, head of the major crimes department, and I go up and spend some time up there and went, ho. I saw myself all over again at that age, and you want to know something? It was sickening and disgusting. I was not proud of one single minute of that. I took a little bit of that responsibility, whether I was right, wrong, or indifferent. I felt really bad about that. And I mentioned this program. He knew about the program. He'd been down here once in a while. And if I was getting a cake or something, he'd come down and heard some great speakers. But you know what? You could lead that horse to water. You can't make him drink. I could leave all the hints I wanted. I could talk. I could do whatever. And he'd agree with everything I said. And 2 hours later, he's got a beer in his hand, staggering around, and everything's just fine in his world. And tonight, he gets a cake for 20 years. You know how much I had to do with that? Zero. I was down here, and he called me. I'm in AA, he said. I think I got a problem. I think I'm going to see if this program works. And guess what? So now you sit, you're a little bit new, you're very much like I was, and you say, wow, you can't get 40. I remember sitting right here. They used to have tables that ran along this way. I was sitting right there, and a guy come up here, and he got a cake with one candle on it, a one-year cake. And I thought to myself, nobody can stay sober for a whole year. A whole year? Come on, guys. And all of a sudden, I don't even know what happened. I had that year. By the way, that lady kept me at arm's length. You're not even going to believe this part of the story. I got sober. I started doing the right thing. And I'm a son of a gun. Next thing I know, I don't think I moved at all. And boom, she's right there. And pretty quick here. The 30th of this month, we'll be married 35 years. So If I told you, and I told you the truth, and I will, that in 1981, when I came here and got a hold of things and had 30 or 60 or 90 days of sobriety, I think if you'd have said to me, hey, Jim, how about I guarantee you a job in a bank as a loan officer, and you could do that the rest of your life, we'll just let you have that job, I would have sold out so fast you wouldn't believe. I'd have been so glad to have something like that. I had no clue, no idea, in my wildest dreams, what would ever happen by getting back into that current. What would ever happen by coming to these meetings and hearing people like you gripe and whine. The old timers used to tell us, you know how this thing works? We talk it to death. We talk it to death. Think about that. Isn't that what we do? We talk these things to death. And somebody comes and they say, I got a problem. And you say to them, what's the problem? Let's talk about it. And you know what? We've heard some really gritty problems. We've heard some problems I didn't think were too bad, but they weren't happening to me. I've heard some other problems that went, whoa. But a drink will never make the problem any better. I don't care what it is. I don't care what level it's on. Alcohol does not help it. Marijuana does not help it. Drugs do not help it. They'll never, ever, ever help a problem. So if you're here and you're wondering why you're here, I'm going to tell you something. Keep your mind open. Give it a chance. Keep coming back. Keep talking about it. And you know what? What works for me doesn't always work for everybody. And I get that. I understand that. A speaker once told me, if I say something you don't like, don't agree with, or doesn't click for you, just kick it under the chair and leave it for the next guy. It doesn't have to work for me. Just let it go. Don't get all upset about it. Don't run over to Denny's and have 4 cups of coffee and an ice cream sundae and bitch about the speaker. Let it go, man. Grab on to what you can hang on to. And when a speaker says something like, you know, they wrecked 7 cars or they've been to jail, you know what? I've never been to jail. One of the reasons I didn't want to come to AA, I never had a DUI. Ever. Ever. Not one. There may be a reason for that, because my family was pretty well known and respected. And by the way, back in those days, if you did get stopped, they'd scold you and drive you home or take you home or some other deal. So I found out all that bragging I was doing meant nothing. It was just a lot different circumstance and a lot different day back then. But keep your mind open. Keep coming back. Listen to what people have to say and try to relate to their experiences. You may not relate to the stuff I went through. You may not relate to the jobs or the careers or the women or the whatever it was, or the type of alcohol, but if you relate to the experiences and the emotions and the feelings we all go through the same thing. Our lives are all different stories. Down in here, same thing, same deal. So, my dad used to tell me there's no souls saved after 8 o'clock, and if we quit early, everybody will be really happy. I'm about wrapped up, okay? I'm just gonna tell you, if you're an alcoholic like I am, this is where you need to be. This is where you need to be a lot. Be available to help other people. Listen to them. Don't butt in the middle of their story and tell them something. I will kind of leave you with this one. I love it when speakers say, I'm going to leave you with something, and they talk another 20 minutes. I'm not going to do that to you, but I did a this lady that sponsored me was about this tall and very mild, very meek, tremendously insightful, but a very quiet lady. And so it came time for me to do, I did my fourth step, and I wrote all that stuff out, and now it comes time for the fifth step, and I went, oh, my God, this lady is so nice, and she's so wonderful, and she had all the surprise. I don't dare. If she ever found out some of the stuff I did, she'll probably never speak to me again. I'll never see her at AA again. She'll quit coming, and I blow that thing all to pieces. And so the night came. Believe it or not, I lived in an apartment by myself at that time when I first got sober. It's kind of funny. There's nobody flocking around wanting to be my friend. And she came over, and she said, well, what have you got? I said, I've got all this stuff written down. And she goes, well, let's hear it. And I said, okay. So I put my head down and I started reading. And as I'm reading the stuff that I had written and some of the things I had done, I wanted to pull a cord and just disappear. I didn't want to be there for the rest of the conversation. I was so ashamed and embarrassed and humiliated by some of the crap I had caused other people, some of what I'd been through. It was almost more than you can, it was just almost too much. And I got all done, and I was afraid to look at her. I was out of breath. I was emotional. I was about to cry. And I look at her, and she's looking back at me. And I said, so are you going to say anything? And she said, you must be tired. And that's all she said. You must really be tired. I didn't shock her one single bit. She made no judgment about anything that I said. She just said, you must be tired. Now, she said, tear that thing up. We're going to burn it here in a plate at the table, and that's the end of it. Don't go back to it. She said, it's like a graveyard. It's okay to visit once in a while, but don't linger there. Go there, pay your respects, and get back out again. And by the way, she said, we're doing those 12 steps. And there's a reason people put, numbers on those steps, and that's for people like you. So you don't have to do step number 11 and then come back and do 7 and then do 4. You do number 1. And if you get to number 2 and you hang up, you go back and do number 1 again. And we're going to walk through those till we got them all 12 done. And that's exactly what we did. So I don't want to hear from anybody that those steps aren't for you. I wasn't that bad. I wasn't something. They're written for all of us. So I will tell you, I saw a thing happen right here in this club. And this is this actually before I got sober, this story is more than 40 years old. I used to have a fellow named Dwight Daniels. I'm using his last name because he passed away now. He had a really old, out-of-tune piano sitting here in this corner. Dwight was a piano player. And boy, when he played Happy Birthday, you could hear that piano clear down to Broadway all over town. And this guy, I swear I thought he was a lumberjack. He was the biggest man I ever saw in my life, and rugged, tough-looking, big muscles. And he got up from over here, and he comes walking over to get his cake with one candle on it. I even have trouble telling this story today. A little girl, that big, comes walking with one candle on the cake and walks over and hands it to him. And he turned around to the crowd, and the tears were streaming down this giant's face, streaming, face beat red. And he said, "Man, I ain't never had it so good. And tonight I'm going to leave you with that thought. I ain't never had it so good." Thank you. God bless.
All right, let's give it up for Jim one more time.